Hello, everybody. Before we dive into today's episode, we are brought to you by Elite Sweets. Elite Sweets is redefining the way we think about sweets with their elite donuts. The Elite Donut is a better-for-you donut that is packed with 13 grams of protein, gluten-free, keto-friendly, and contains only 1 gram of sugar. As I'm recording this today, Elite Sweets recently came out with their new shelf-stable donut. So the donuts that we all love from Elite Sweets are now shelf-stable. You no longer have to put them in the fridge or freeze them. You can keep them right there in your pantry, bring them with you on the go, and they're good to go. I love Elite Sweets. They are always packed at our house, ready to go for a snack that is indulgent, but it doesn't ruin all of the hard-earned work you're doing outside the kitchen. Again, it's high in protein, gluten-free, keto-friendly, and contains only 1 gram of sugar. They have a new flavor, maple, which is delicious. You can get yours today at elitedonut.com or on Amazon, the two easiest places to get the donuts. By using code ShaneWhite30, you'll also get 30% off your order. They're also popping out into retail, so keep an eye out right as of today, filming this before the podcast. They're in 7-Eleven in the Dallas area, so if you're listening to this from Dallas, you can head over to 7-Eleven and pick up some Elite Donuts for yourself. Like I said, they're delicious. Give them a shot. Use code ShaneWhite30 for 30% off your order at elitedonut.com or on Amazon. We're also brought to you by Routine. When we sleep, we lose between a pound and 1.5 pounds of water from expelling vapors, sweating, for lots of different reasons, mainly from sweating. When you wake up in the morning, you have the cup of coffee. First thing you do, you just dehydrate yourself even further. So why not use a product like Morning Routine? It's a single serve packet that contains half an organic lemon, 1 tablespoon of apple cider vinegar, Himalayan sea salt, all 6 essential electrolytes, and most importantly, no sugar. I tear one of these, mix it into a little cup of water, usually with my pre-workout or something first thing in the morning. I genuinely feel more hydrated, more vibrant, more ready to go for the day once I have my morning routine. It is really strange. It's one of those products that if I don't use it consistently, I do genuinely feel a major difference in just the way I feel throughout my morning and ultimately my day. So check out Morning Routine. If you want to give it a shot, go to their website, yourroutine.com. Use code ShaneWhite30 at checkout for 30% off your first order. We're also brought to you today by NeuroRoast. NeuroRoast is a company dedicated to helping you optimize your brain function and overall well-being. NeuroRoast's flagship product is their premium mushroom coffee, which is made with an organic single origin coffee and their signature blend of 5 different functional mushrooms: cordyceps, lion's mane, reishi, turkey tail, and chaga. Mushroom coffee is a new and exciting way to supercharge your day. Unlike regular coffee, which can cause jitters and crashes, mushroom coffee provides a more balanced and sustained energy boost, allowing you to stay focused and productive throughout the day. And with NeuroRoast's ground and instant coffee options, you can enjoy the benefits of mushroom coffee wherever and whenever you need it. And here's some great news for my listeners today. NeuroRoast is offering an exclusive discount code just for you. If you want to use code ShaneWhite during checkout at NeuroRoast.com, that's NeuroRoast.com, you can get 30% off your order. Whether you choose ground or instant options, they're all available for you. And again, that's code ShaneWhite30 for 30% off your order at NeuroRoast.com. So if you're looking for a natural and delicious way to boost your focus, memory, and overall cognitive function, give NeuroRoast Mushroom Coffee a try. With their commitment to quality and sustainability, you can trust that you're getting the best possible coffee for your brain and your body. And again, one last time, don't forget to use the code ShaneWhite30 at checkout to save 30% off your order. For all of you listening today, I will add the links for NeuroRoast, Routine, and Elite Sweets to the show notes. So go there, click on the links, and don't forget to use the discount code to get some percentages off. All right, everybody, thanks for listening. The episode is up next. All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Shane White Show. I am pumped today to have Kevin Lee of Emmy on the podcast. And Kevin, did I pronounce that right? Emmy?
That's correct.
Awesome. There we go. That's always like the first hurdle on a podcast is making sure you make the pronunciation correctly.
Nailed it.
Thank you. Kevin, welcome to the show, first and foremost. For everyone listening, would you mind giving everyone a little bit of a background and just a rundown on you and the brand?
Definitely. First off, thanks so much for having me on here. It's funny because I realized before we started, we didn't get to clarify, like, is it Emmy? Is it Imy or whatever? And I was like, damn, you nailed it. So that was
solid. I always mean to ask that. And then it's always me introducing live. And I'm like, Shit, I never asked this before I hit record. So
I literally
I got
was,
lucky.
Like, racing through my mind when you were starting. I was like, oh, man, I hope he gets it.
He's going to butcher
like,
this.
You got it. But yeah, appreciate you having me on. My name is Kevin Lee. So I'm one of the co-founders of Emmy. It's funny because my other co-founder is also named Kevin. And so I call him K-Chan and I'm K-Lee. We just append our last names. We both met actually a decade ago in the tech industry of all places. So both of us used to get like noodles for breakfast every day. And we started sharing more about our family backgrounds. And we realized we came from very similar backgrounds. So my grandparents are produce farmers in Taiwan.
Oh, wow.
When I was a child, my parents, you know, left me in Taiwan to stay with them after my parents immigrated to the U.S. And then basically from that point on, like every summer or winter, I'd kind of go back to Taiwan. And so I spent a lot of time in the fields with them, just picking, stemming, packaging fruit. It was a totally different experience. CPG.
Yeah.
It's definitely right. More like serving fruit to like these markets and such. My co-founder's grandmother actually ran a pretty famous egg noodle hawker stall out in Thailand. And then when his parents immigrated to the U.S., his dad started running a Thai supermarket and then later opened a Thai restaurant, also selling noodles. And so we kind of joke it's in our blood. And you know,
yeah,
at some
no joke.
Point, we had to kind of come back to this. But we would talk about these things. And then you know, we kind of went different paths afterwards. So he stayed in product management for 10 years. And I did a little bit more in product and then moved on to early stage venture capital, where I was investing in consumer tech. And at a certain point, I started leading food and beverage investing at a firm called Pear Ventures. And that was around the time me and K-Chan, we have obviously stayed close friends. We were even roommates at a point, but we started talking about what we were seeing in the food industry, and our families were getting sicker because, you know, my grandmother, for example, is pre-diabetic. Both my parents take medication for high blood pressure. And so we said, well, look, we come from these Asian food families, and from what we're seeing in our respective roles, he was leading the social video team at Facebook, and he obviously got a lot of access to interesting ad data over there.
Yeah, bet.
I was in the venture capital industry talking to a lot of food brands, talking to buyers at these supermarkets, and kind of a consistent theme that kept coming up was there is this obviously better for you is never going away. I think once people realize they're more aware of what they eat and they eat healthier, it's kind of hard to go back to eating junk, you know, shitty food.
Oh, right.
And then the other thing that was happening was this rise of global flavors. So it was interesting back a few years ago, you know, we heard from like the Whole Foods buyers that they were seeing that global flavors were just like blowing up, where, you know, shoppers are coming to the store and they were like, well, where can we find these like Asian flavors? And so K-Chan and I got together and we said, well, can we reinvent some of these staple Asian American foods we grew up eating, but make them much more nutritious, use better ingredients? And instant ramen kind of came, it surfaced because it's one of the world's most popular foods. It's a $50 billion market. No one has reinvented it in 60 years. And it's like one of those things that's kind of a sleeper. It's like you probably had it when you were in college or as a child. And then you were just like, I don't really want to eat this as an adult anymore unless I'm like wasted at 2 a.m.
Right. So, yeah. It comes off as like the cheap college, like if I'm out of money, go buy ramen.
Exactly. And it's sometimes it's kind of funny. That's almost become one of our recent taglines is like, we're not your college instant ramen. It's like a fun
Love
thing
that.
To say.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was kind of the impetus behind Emmy. And then I'm happy to go into the whole.
Sure.
You know,
R&D Super cool. There. I mean, I think I told you before we started recording, I'm just always looking for, I'm just always looking at what brands are popping. I love talking to people on here, obviously. So it's just organic for me. And I can't remember where I first came across you guys, but it doesn't happen that often anymore because I've been in the industry for a little bit now too, where I come across a product that's better for you. And I was like, damn, that is a product that, why has no one thought to do that? So that's really cool, first of all. And I think your guys' packaging and just overall brand messaging shouts that, which I think is fantastic.
Thank you.
And for you guys, I find this very interesting because I work with a few people who have similar, it seems like, founders that have similar backgrounds to you and K-Chan.
Mm-hmm.
where you both were in professional industries and actually almost got to see behind the fold how things work. And then you're like, well, I could go launch something like that. Could you give everyone who's listening a little bit more depth into that? Like, as you and being in venture capital, you said, right?
Yeah.
Being in venture capital, I mean, you must have reviewed God knows how many brands and looked at their P&Ls and like understood how they operated. For you, did you feel like, I guess my question is very long-winded here, but it's interesting because I think when you made the jump and you decided to do this, did you feel like you already had some validation behind knowing how an operational CPG brand should look on paper? Because I think a lot of people just get into it because they have a passion. And yeah, it sounds like you actually had some, you had a skill set that was very relatable to launching your own brand.
It's actually funny you say that, because I think when I was at the other firm, Pear Ventures, I was mostly focused on tech. And it wasn't until I think, I don't remember exactly when, but at some point, one of the founders, Pagemon, he got to know my story and my family's story. And he's really big on like authentically leaning into your background and your story.
Okay.
And you know, he has this whole crazy story of like, he came over from Iran homeless, worked at like a rug store selling rugs, and then like became the first angel investor in Dropbox. And like his whole thing is just like, he's the most unorthodox like VC you can see, but he really leans into that background.
And yeah,
when he heard that I came from like an Asian food family, he was like, Kevin, you got to lean into that. And he started introducing me. He's like, this is Kevin. He leads food and beverage investing at Pear. But at the time, it was funny. It's like, I didn't really know much about food and beverage investing. And I think it's definitely helpful to have seen some companies, but I hadn't seen any big successes. Like there wasn't like the Liquid Debts of the world, you know, that I was getting to evaluate. I was just looking at much smaller at the time. Plant-based was just kind of getting off the ground. So we were seeing a lot of plant-based companies, but they were pre-seed seed stage companies that were probably in the R&D phase or had just launched some like CPG bar or protein snack product. So I didn't have a good measurement of what success looked like in the industry, but I did know what success looked like in the tech industry. And it is different, but it's more around like operating principles and like how you can run a good company that I think matters most, because that's applicable no matter what industry you go into. And yeah, I think outside of that, it was more so, you know, what was relevant from the venture capital industry was being surrounded by entrepreneurs on a day in, day out basis, where you're hearing these pitches, you're realizing that these people are normal people just like you. They just decided to take that leap of faith. And that really normalized it, I think, more than anything of, hey, you know, I don't come from like a great, you know, I don't have a lot of social capital, financial capital. My family did not either, but there's certain knowledge that I was able to glean from watching these entrepreneurs. And it was more of a mindset that I was able to glean that then convinced me, hey, you know, we have this idea, just like you said, Shane, like we kept wondering, why didn't anyone reinvent instant ramen before? And we were like, you know what, if everyone's like asking the same question, we should probably just go be the crazy ones and go do it.
Oh, I love that. No, that's a great mentality. And what did you guys find when you started looking around to see why people hadn't done it? Did you guys come to any conclusion?
It's funny, we barely did any competitive research, and it's probably the worst way to go about this, but Kitchen and I, when we got together, I remember distinctly, we were in like my apartment and we were like, what do you want to work on? And we were like, well, we both love noodles. Like we kind of come from that space, and it's like, you know, a food that we always wish when we ate ramen, like that it wasn't so heavy and like we didn't have food comas and it, you know, didn't raise our blood sugar, like, cause we have a family history of diabetes in our families.
Sure.
So we were like, let's just work on like a low carb instant ramen. And then what we did from there was we actually did quite a bit of demand testing. So as like unsophisticated as I made it sound just now, like I would say where we did try to be sophisticated is in that, like, let's make sure this is a product people want before we build anything. And smart. This was really a mindset we gleaned from our product management days, where you kind of have to test iteratively as you launch features, you measure results, you determine how to set your roadmap. The second was we did get a chance to learn from other people in the industry. So one of my close friends at the time, this guy named Wilson, he had joined this company called Kettle and Fire. It was like the fastest growing bone broth brand of all time. And I got to know the CEO, Justin Mayers. And Justin really taught us like that concept of, hey, demand test everything, build landing pages, you know, mock up wireframes, whatever, of your product. And I think where we took it one step further was we found this widget at the time that allowed us to collect pre-orders on our own website. It wasn't like Kickstarter or anything. And so we would start to collect pre-orders. We would email those people and do user research with them. So we'd say like, hey, why did you buy this product? Very like non-leading questions. You're just trying to glean as much information as possible. And then they start to give you valuable information that you can then start using for other tests. So from there, once we realized, hey, there is demand for this product at the price point that we want. And by the way, it was so crazy because we would email these people and we'd be like, hey, we don't actually have a product. We may have a product in like a year or two.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask, like, did you actually have something to sell?
We didn't have anything to sell. And some people are like, sometimes I tell that story and people are like, oh, that's so crazy and misleading. Like, you tricked these people. But no, I think the intention was like, we were very honest when we emailed these people. We said, look, shoot this. We don't have this product, but we are planning to build this. Like, do you want, like, what do you want us to do with your money? We're 100% happy to refund it. And literally 50% of the people said, I want you to keep my money and just ship me the product when it's done.
No way.
Even with no timeline on product development. And I think that to us is like one of the strongest signs that there is like a hair on fire problem in the industry is if like people are literally like, I don't care when you're going to build it. Like, just give it to me when it's ready.
Oh yeah.
That's like a pure signal that you have something interesting. And then where we took that a step further, we did a series of ad tests where we tested like, you know, 10 different audience groups on Facebook. Back then you could do a lot more audience targeting. And we started to figure out like, okay, here are the audiences that were really interested in this concept of like a low carb instant ramen. And then once we found the winning audiences, we then tested different value props. We were like, okay, do they care about like gluten-free or non-GMO or high protein? And then you start to figure out, okay, with this audience that cares about this product, here are the value props they care about the most. And that really lets you then start to prioritize what feature sets you should ensure you incorporate into the product. So we took this type of approach before we did any R&D, you know, in our own kitchens. And yes, it's hard and painful. And we had zero experience in food science or chefs ourselves, but at least it gave us the constraints by which we could let our creativity flow. And by creativity, I mean like ignorance and like naivety and knowing nothing. Like, we were just like, okay, we know what we have to build. We have no idea how to get there. Let's just go figure it out.
You two sound genuinely curious too, which is, I think, a huge part of entrepreneurship in general. And sometimes it seems like some of the biggest success stories that I've talked to on here and just in general listening to entrepreneurship success stories is having some of that, like, I don't know exactly what we're getting into. And instead of doing all that market research to make sure it's perfect, you just jump in and like kind of get an, you sound like you guys got like a minimal viable product that actually had some validation, which is huge too, right? I mean, I think that was a huge, good, smart decision early on.
I think it was that, and just like you said, like, we are very curious people, but we also just had so much fun. It was
okay.
Like, I also say, like, find a co-founder where you're just gonna have fun regardless of what you're doing together.
For yeah, that's us, great it was advice.
Like, we would hang out together, work on like making noodle recipes in the kitchen. We'd like roll the dough, wait for it to set, like, you know, hang out, and then
like
study the results. And so it just never really felt like work. And part of the curiosity, like you said, was like, we're trying to learn a new industry from scratch. So every time something messed up, like, why did this dough ball end up too sticky? Like, we started to realize that if during different times of the year, because we spent like 8 to 9 months during our full-time jobs working on this nights and weekends, we're like, how in the summer, like, the dough is like totally different in the winter? We were like, oh, it's because the humidity in our apartment is like slightly different. And that actually affects the dough and the texture. And we were like, holy shit, there's no way we would have known this unless we had literally made like 10 versions at like different times of the year and then somehow came to this conclusion. So it was a very exciting process. And I would say, like, yeah, keep that, stay curious, like, throughout your R&D.
That's wild. Just, yeah, because that alone, right? Like, that, you kind of got a crash course in food science without realizing you were doing it, right?
Exactly. And it keeps you naive too, because, not keeps you naive. You are naive, but by not knowing anything about the industry, you are more likely, I think, to discover things that the experts would not find themselves. Like, a lot of these like noodle experts, we spoke to a bunch of PhDs, a lot of them were just like, hey, if this hasn't been done in like 60 years, it's probably because it's not possible from a food physics standpoint. Like, you probably are just dealing with too many constraints from a nutritional as well as textural standpoint. And we were kind of just like, well, we don't really understand what you're saying, so we're just going to keep going. and then we just like, we literally created, I think, like, it was like the 200 version of IMI was like an accident. We had flown up to Seattle to meet with like some of our advisors. We found this like chef advisor and this like food science PhD advisor. Both of them had nothing to do with noodles. They just were like friendlies. And
then, that's cool.
And then we just ran out of our core ingredient at the time. So we went to a local natural grocery, and like literally the last protein they had was pumpkin seed protein. And it, I just remember Kachin like bumped into it on the way out, 'cause we were like, fuck, we have nothing here. And then we tested it and it worked out and it ended up being like the core ingredient. We were like, oh my God, just like accidents happen all the time in labs. So why can't they just happen in the kitchen too?
Yeah. Wow. So that's, I mean, that's crazy. All of that's nuts. I mean, you guys were kind of just trying to figure it out. And one of the questions I think you actually, you said a little bit, but I wanted to go back to, while you guys are tinkering with this and trying to figure it out and you're, you know, you're networking and trying to come up with a product that's going to work, did you guys have your full-time jobs, it sounded like, for a little bit? Like you were kind of doing this on the side, I'm guessing nights, weekends. Is that how that was at first?
We did it nights, weekends for about 8 months, maybe like a little bit longer. I think it was actually really hard to figure out when we should quit our jobs. And it was really when we got closer to our first formulation where we were like, okay, we have this first formulation. We think we have a lead on a possible co-manufacturer. Let's quit. And in hindsight, I think we probably could have waited a little bit longer, because setting up that manufacturer took probably a year, and it was just like a lot of dead time. But it was also dead time that we tried to use to build demand, where we were building up, like we were able to build this wait list of 35,000 people. We built this private community of 3,800 people.
35,000, you said?
Yeah, it was. I have a lot of stories there too, on what we did there. But yeah, it was like, I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, it's like hindsight 2020, right? It's like, I'm always like, oh, we could have left, but then maybe we wouldn't have built that wait list. So I don't know the right answer.
No, that makes sense. I mean, and I don't think there's necessarily a right answer. But what I do think is interesting is, just anecdotally, it sounds like from what I know about tech, I mean, you guys had to have been making pretty good money doing what you were doing in full-time jobs. And this is such a leap into a whole nother world. At that time, were either of you like married, or did you have anything else that you were responsible for? Because I think that's a big piece of entrepreneurship too. When I talk to so many people on here, I realize like timing is so much of the story for you guys. So at that point, like, were you responsible for other people or a mortgage or anything else that was making you second guess leaving your job?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. My co-founder and I don't have safety nets at all. Like both of our families are, you know, immigrants from different countries. And I think especially in our, like in Asian culture, you're really taught to take care of your families. Like, you know, as you get older, it's not like you leave the nest and you're just gone and independent. So but on both of our minds constantly is like the security of our families, obviously our loved ones as well. But yes, it was a very hard decision. I guess I sometimes like thinking about the first 2 years was really rough, because for both of us to give up, yeah, that the tech income, of course, was huge. But then, you know, you're basically like, we didn't pay ourselves, and it was just, it is a really tough time. And luckily we had our partners. Now my wife was my fiance at the time and girlfriend. Yeah. Same thing with my co-founder. We got married like within 6 months of one another.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, yeah. Our partners were huge supports, I think, during that time. But yeah, I mean, I don't really have a good answer there, man. I just think it was like scary and rough. And I think I know many entrepreneurs who didn't even have the luxury of coming from like a tech background and didn't have savings necessarily, or even like partners to be that maybe like a stable bedrock for them. So I'm just lucky we kind of came out of it.
Yeah, no. And it's funny. The reason I asked that question is I do think, for better or for worse, there's a lot of flashiness around entrepreneurship, and just like you see people when they get on the other side of it, and then everyone's like, oh, wow, how lucky they are. And I don't think a lot of people fully understand the stress that goes into making that leap, right? And obviously, a vast majority of people never make the leap that have the idea or the concept. So I give you a lot of praise for that, because I think just in that decision alone for you two, both the Kevins in this, like, you know, you guys could have made the decision the other way to be like, let's just slow down. Let's keep our full-time jobs. We're making good money. And who knows, maybe Emmy wouldn't have taken off. And to your point, you wouldn't have built this huge list of consumers. It's funny when you said 35,000, I thought you said 3,500, which I was like, oh, that's still pretty impressive. 35,000 is a ton though. Mm-hmm. That's huge. So you guys were building that before you had a product. Like, you had 35,000 people in your pipeline before you had a product to sell.
Yeah. It's, you know, when it took us, quite some time to get when we did the R&D and the commercialization, we had, you know, just basically empty dead time while we were waiting for the manufacturers to get back to us. And we had to just think of creative ways to grow that waiting list without any marketing budget. We were bootstrapping at the time. So we did all sorts of creative, crazy things that I kind of wish we kept in our DNA even to this day, now that, you know, we've already raised some venture. But back in the day, I once wrote this story on LinkedIn, and we found this bot that would scrape all of Reddit for any mention of any keywords that you would like input. So
Whoa.
At the time we were like, okay, people out there are probably looking for like a low carb or like a keto friendly noodle or like low carb ramen or healthy ramen. So we're like, anytime anywhere on Reddit those words are mentioned, I want to be the first to know about it. And so we integrated that bot into our Slack. We would get pings throughout the week. And then literally I would just click into the post or the comment and I would read it, get the context, and then link. I would basically like write a response, be like, hey, I saw you talking about low carb ramen. Did you know that we're working on this? That's going to come out in like a year. Here's a link to our landing page. And sometimes
what a scrappy, smart way to do that, Kevin.
It was super scrappy. It took us, I mean, it was not scalable at all, but with one well-placed comment, if that comment was on a post that then went to like the top of, let's say, like the keto subreddit, you would get like 500 emails within like an hour of people who would just like click through and sign up. And it was so fun actually back in the day, because it was all about like trying to find the best use of our time. Like, which one should we respond to? I know like at a certain point, our account actually got like temporarily suspended from like the keto subreddit because we were just commenting way too much. And the moderators were like, what the heck are you guys doing? So we switched our strategy and we started delivering value first, which is obviously what you should do in any situation. So we started
like Gary Vee mentality.
Yeah, exactly. Jab, jab, right hook. So we, K-Chan, he loves like in his personal life, he really loves like photography and like a little bit of videography. So he brought over some like camera equipment, and then we started this like mini YouTube series. It's not up anymore, but it was called the Ramen Lab, where we would take our noodles and we'd make these like really random recipes, like Millionaire's Bacon Carbonara using low carb IMI noodles. And then we would spend like half a day filming it. Then we found like a freelance videographer to cut it and turn it into like a GIF, like a 10 to 20 second GIF. And then we would post these on subreddits, like cooking, again, like keto, low carb. And for like a couple months, we were like basically top five in some of these subreddits every single week. And that's how we drove a ton of email signups that way as well. So we did a bunch of these like little hacky things that were not scalable, but that's how we got to that 35,000 email wait list. And it's one of the reasons why we were able to kind of have a very strong out the gate launch from building that demand.
That's incredible. And you said the videos aren't up anymore. Is there a reason for that? Because I feel like as you guys scale and keep getting bigger, going back and seeing those initial videos would be super cool.
They were super cringe, I'm going to be perfectly honest.
Okay.
It was, well, we feel.
You know what's funny though? As you get better and better and bigger and bigger, those cringy videos are going to be, they'll be funny to look back at someday. Hopefully you saved them somewhere.
I hope so. We do have them delisted on our account. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I think this was like before I think TikTok got super big. And so in hindsight, it was like, we should have just done this like on TikTok organic or something and then kept it going.
Yeah.
It was also a lot of founder time required for us both to like be in actors in the film or whatever, and then like edit
it.
Or
and trying to like build an actual business.
Yeah.
That's wild. Very cool. And so you build all this. When you turn the switch on and you have a product to sell, how many, I don't know if you know if you remember, but like what percentage or how many of those 35,000 transacted that were ready to buy that you had in the pipeline?
So I actually have this crazy stat, which is when we were building that email waitlist of 35,000, what we were also doing was like as part of our welcome sequence, we would try to push people towards this like private Facebook group. It was a private Facebook community that we started. And a lot of people are always like, Facebook, like why are you guys on Facebook? And we were like, well, it's funny because when we were doing that demand testing in the early days with the ad test to try to find our winning audiences, we actually found that majority of the people who are interested in like IMI in the early days were 35 plus females. That was like 70 to 80% of people who were like clicking on these like mock ads and like putting pre-orders down. And when me and K-Chan were in the tech industry, we just knew that that was a demographic that lived on Facebook. That may have changed now, but that was clearly the case back then. So a lot of people overthink like, where should we start a community? Should it be a Discord and IG groups or whatever? It's like, no, go where your users already are. Don't make it difficult for them. They're a 35 plus female at the time was not going to be downloading a Discord app and like dealing with all these channels. So we built this Facebook community and we just knew that a lot of people who, when you start a new brand or a new company and you have this email list, you'll like send an occasional email to them in a way to like nurture the list or build a relationship. I just don't think that's enough in today's world. Like you having something like a private Facebook community where you can interface with your audience and your audience can interface with each other, that's really where a true community happens, is like the you to them to you, and them to them relationship. So in that Facebook community, we started just like, it was, again, not scalable. It was me in there responding to every single comment, creating conversation topics, posting photos of like me and K-Chan like in the kitchens, connecting people together. It was like when they had hobbies or interests. And we just tried to create this nurturing community. So we had 3,800 people in the community. It was only 10% of the size of our email list. But in the first month of launch, that Facebook community probably generated something like 50% of all the month one sales, even though that community was only 10% the size of our email list. And I think that just goes to show the power of an engaged community that truly is bought into the brand. They felt like they were building alongside us in those 2 years of just like R&D commercialization. We didn't even have a product to give them, but we were so open about sharing our lives and like the trials and tribulations. And even like when we went to eat at like noodle restaurants, we literally take photos of our bowls and be like, hey guys, what do you guys think about this noodle bowl? It has nothing to do with Emmy, but it's just like me eating noodles, and people would just be like super fervent about it. So I think
interesting
in today's society, people are, I hate to say it, people are lonely. They're looking for community. They're looking for a group to rally around. For these folks, like this Facebook community was that for them. They would literally come home from work and they would be like in there talking to us in these threaded comments. And I remember when we launched, a lot of these people, they would be like, I remember there was like a couple mothers in there. They were like, Kevins, we're so proud of you. We feel like you guys are like our second sons. Like,
that's incredible,
part
man.
Of their family. And I think we could have sold anything and they probably would have bought into it. They even fought for us in the comments, where they would go and add comments and literally like respond to trolls on our behalves without us telling them to do that. So,
wow. So, I mean, that's just a very interesting takeaway for anyone listening to this today, because you guys went so on the offensive, it sounds like more so than any brand I've actually ever talked to, that you guys were just more concerned about building really an audience and a loyal community around a concept. And I do think there's something to be said about you brought them along for the journey versus waiting for this finished product and then having all this flash and just worrying about sales, which is, I think, a lot of brands and a lot of people do, right? Like, how many brands do we all know where never heard about it until the product was ready to go, and they've probably been working on it, like you said, for a year, 2 years, who knows how long. Cool. And so you launched then, and I'm assuming that was on like your own website. Is that correct?
Yeah, we launched on our website first. And it's funny because when we first launched, we had like, we're now on version 3 of our product. And the first version of our product was like totally subpar in our minds. I know every founder probably says that they're like the most critical, but we truly believe it was like very subpar at the time compared to what our golden standard was. But going back to like this fervent community, they're patient and they are willing to accept your flaws because we were transparent with them. And we told them, we were like, look guys, here are the constraints we're dealing with. Here's like the manufacturing constraints. Here's where we're trying to get to. And they kind of went along for the ride with us. And it's funny because some of our top performing ads today, we're very vulnerable in these ads where we're like, here's our story, guys. We like had this great idea. We built this like amazing demand. We launched it and the product sucked. And we had to spend a whole year like reinventing the product. And people just like loved that story because it wasn't like, you guys are like on the up and up only. Like there's actually like a character flaw here, or there's like a story narrative where it's not all like roses and butterflies. It's you guys actually tried to do something. It didn't work out. And then you had to restart. And I don't know where I was going with this, but I think going back to like that community has been there every step of the way, to a point now where even after we're in retail now, we're in like Whole Foods, a few of the retailers, our community will still go into like their local Whole Foods and they'll literally buy out the entire aisle, and they'll like post photos where they'll be like, hey, look, not only did I buy all the packets, I bought the boxes that the packets are held in, just to like show the support and like have something I can keep as like a collectible. And that's just not something you can buy, you know, with ad dollars. So it takes years of building that relationship.
There's brands that have been around for 100 years that don't have that kind of brand loyalty. Wild, man. And so you guys start on the website, you build obviously an enormous brand loyalty that then spills over into Whole Foods and early retail. Are you guys at the stage now where are you attacking the distribution game? Like, are you trying to get into as many doors as you can? Are you being very strategic about where Emmy is being sold? I would love to understand that, because I mean, I know we got into the details of how you guys kind of came to market, but that obviously, and to give you a little background why I'm asking that, I worked at RX Bar back in the day.
Nice.
And so that whole strategy and retail strategy is one that I'm intimately aware with. But for you guys, it sounds like it was so tech driven and e-commerce focused to start. I'd love to know how you guys made the leap and decided to expand into retail and then what it looks like today.
Yeah, the retail is interesting. I think we had no knowledge of retail going into it. And I'm sure you know from RX Bar, it's very different from e-com. It's completely, yeah. It can be a very different skill set completely. A lot of the lingo is just crazy. Like to this day, I still am struggling to understand a lot of the trade spend terms and like all the allowances and how it flows through everything.
My role at RX Bar was revenue management. So my team was responsible for all trade spend. So we should talk offline. I can at least give you what I learned with the good and the bad.
Cool. That'd be awesome. We're still making mistakes today, but
I think it's complicated on purpose too, not to cut you off. Part of me, like what I learned is like, I genuinely think they make it hard and complicated to confuse people. So
I hope that makes you
feel better today. Yeah.
That's so funny. Yeah, I think with e-commerce, we quickly realized that, I mean, it's not really like rocket science, like asking someone to buy a pack, like a bundle of like 6 or 12. And for most D2C brands, you have to do that because the shipping costs are so expensive. You just won't make a contribution margin profit unless you do that. People don't want to do that on a regular basis. They're not thinking about buying food in that way. It was very obvious to us even from the get-go that like we had to be in retail. When we think about our own ramen purchasing habits, I have never bought ramen online from like the old existing brands. I don't know why we thought we could do it with this, but I guess we did enough demand testing that we're like, hey, maybe shopper habits have changed. But in retail, when we launched in Whole Foods, we kind of did a trial with just 5 of their regions just to ensure like, hey, we got to make sure the price point works. Like there's not really a way to demand test it in the same way you could in online.
Sure.
Well, outside of just like asking our audience if they'd be down to buy it in retail, which most people were like, yes, we want to do that. So when we launched in Whole Foods in 5 of the regions, we kind of quickly just very saw this spike in velocity right out the gate and like, you know, surpassing category averages fairly quickly with no trade spend or anything like that, no promo calendar in place. And it gave us that confidence to say, hey, you can't really fake that kind of retail data because, you know, there's a limited number of shoppers within the radius of each store. So if you're maintaining velocity growth, that means that people are actually coming back and repeat purchasing. And it just
And were you guys sitting on shelf with other ramen brands? Like were you in the same set? Okay.
Yeah, we're sitting in the same set in their global flavors category. So yeah, it's crazy because like there's a lot of existing brands there who've been around for 20, 30 years, but we were also at an SRP that's like 2 to 3x that of the nearest competitor.
Wow.
And so you would think like, oh, wow, like, is that going to move in retail? But it does. And it just kind of proved a lot of things for us. Like, A, it proved that there is latent demand for like the healthier ramen from these shoppers. And of course, Whole Foods is a much more like, I think, health conscious shopper. But B, it also proved that, you know, we could actually double down in retail and not just rely on D2C for growth. And so it just gave us that confidence to start doubling down. And that's why we've started building out a sales team. We just hired like our director of sales. And we're trying to just really tackle retail in 2023 and beyond.
Nice.
In the meantime, we're not, I think, yet at that blitz scale of like, let's just get as many doors as possible. For us, we've always taken like there's a tech analogy here where there's like the semiconductor company called Intel, and basically they have this method called like the tick tock method, where it's like every few years they do like a tick, which is like a small improvement that is like, and then they do like a tock, which is like a bigger improvement. How I'm bringing that parallel here is like, that's kind of what like IMI has been, where it's like the first 2 years was like our talk of like just trying to like get this product off the ground. And then the tick was like, let's launch it. Let's like grow D2C revenue. The talk again is just like, while we're expanding retail, we also need to bring that price down. And the only way to do that is you get your COGS down too. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of the efforts we're doing now. And I think at the end of this year, we're going to have some serious COGS improvements where we're going to be able to move back into that tick and then get back into like, let's blow out distribution. Because I think once we cross below a certain SRP, that's when we know we're really going to move pretty serious units. And that's what we're pretty excited for.
Wow, that's a cool analogy. I never had heard that before. A tick and a tock.
I might be screwing
very
it up,
cool.
honestly, but
no, but I mean it makes sense. I mean, I think even like as a consumer, what like Apple, I feel like that's exactly what they do, right?
Exactly.
I mean, there's just more like tick 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 tock
yeah.
with iPhones, but
yeah, they'll like shrink it, and then they'll like maybe launch an iPad at some point, and then like shrink
yeah.
it, and then yeah,
exactly. It's like camera improvement, a battery yeah. life maybe improvement. Very cool. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And honestly, again, anecdotal experience. I think that's really smart. The trade spend side, I think it maybe this is a bad thing if I ever wanted to launch a food brand. I have that experience of what can happen with trade spend. And really, it's just surprises. Like I think inevitably for brands that are growing really quick, one of the things that can happen is you either don't understand what the deductions will look like. Mm-hmm. It's hard to get that kind of transparency before you launch into a retailer. And then you're pressured to run promotions, participate in end caps, do all these different things. And then you're growing a sales team too. So it's like everyone's trying to do that in every retailer. And then as the team trying to manage trade spend, it's tough. It's hard thing
For
to
sure.
scale with the organization. So going slow and steady, I think it's so smart, especially for brands nowadays. And one of the things I wanted to ask that maybe we will kind of tie into this is, obviously, you guys have raised a little capital in the past. Mm-hmm. So I would assume, especially with the economic environment, and tell me if I'm wrong, I would assume like profit margins are just an important thing that I'm sure all your investors care about, which then ties back to making really smart decisions as you guys continue to expand. Has that been a piece of your guys' business that's gotten, I don't want to call it more scrutiny, but maybe more focus with just the economic conditions that have happened over the last 12 months? I think it's a question I get a lot just being in the space of just like how focused are other brands, you know, on, mm-hmm. on different parts of the P&L. I'd be super curious just from your perspective, what that's felt like over the last 6 to 12 months. You're talking about COGS improvements and
yeah.
growing distribution and growing a team. So it seems like you have a lot of different, you know, you have a lot of moving pieces that I'm sure are hard to manage. So I would love to get your little take on that.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's also funny because I think when I was doing my annual retrospective, like my annual planning. I always do it like late December. It's my favorite time of the year. And I was planning for it for 2023. And I always pick a word for the year. And for the first time, I picked this word that I kind of like laughed at, and all my friends laughed at. And the word was profit. And people were like, profit? That's like a weird ass word. Like last year's word was like leverage. That sounds like way cooler. And like, what does profit mean? And I was like, no, it's not about like making money per se. It's about the discipline that comes from like looking for profit. It's like in order to get profitable, you literally have to like you have to plan. You can't just
right.
do things like spontaneously. You have to like, you have constraints. You have to be disciplined in how you spend money, disciplined in the processes you follow as a company, you're hiring. And it was more around that where it's like, yes, my co-founder and I are paying extra scrutiny. We always have, but it's ever more apparent because the funding environments have really dried up.
Mm-hmm.
For us, getting COGS down is super critical. Again, going back to leverage, which is my last year's word, figuring out how to help team members lever up so that they can do more with just themselves is super important for us. We tend to hire people who actually don't come from the industry. Like our food scientist, for example, has no food science training or education. He's completely self-taught.
Oh, that's cool.
Our marketer who does like 4 jobs in 1 came from a bank as a UX researcher. And now he covers affiliate, influencer, landing pages, like email, SMS. He's literally doing like 4 people's roles in 1 because we look for people with high ceiling potential, like almost like I would call it an unlimited ceiling potential. And what we then do is we try to ramp them up in ways of like pairing them with mentors in the industry. We give them resources that most other companies would not give them, like their own executive assistants to help handle rote tasks that they shouldn't be doing more than once. We do a lot of automation in this company. So like almost everything is documented via like Loom and written out SOPs. And I think it goes back to that the operating principles I talk about that we picked up, you know, in our previous roles. It's, you can apply these operating principles to any industry. And if you automate and you do a lot of that, levering up the talent in your workforce, like you will do so much more than the standard company who is spending 2 to 3x more than you from like a burn perspective. And it's always been something I think we are proud of internally. Maybe it's like that immigrant mindset of like, we came to this country with nothing. You had to figure out how to do it with nothing. So therefore it's like, we know what it's like to go back to nothing. We're not scared of it, but it also like causes us to operate, I think, more, going back to like that profitability mindset, we care a lot more about these little things. And so, yeah, I would encourage anyone listening, like, just think about the things that you're doing in your company. Like, look at your teams. I'm not telling you to like fire people. I'm just saying, like, before you even hire, ask yourself, can one person do the job of three without burning them out? Like, you're just figuring out how to leverage them up.
That's really, really interesting. What a great response to that. And I love that word of the year. That's a really cool concept. I've never heard of that one before.
Everyone thinks I work in finance or something. I'm like, no, I don't. It's just
that's hilarious. I mean, it's funny you say this because I was just talking. I work in CPG and specifically e-commerce. And I was going to buy this hat I saw the other day. It was an EBITDA hat.
Oh my God.
I started popping up on Instagram. I'm like, I'm starting wearing that on calls with clients. It's funny. That's my background in finance too.
Nice.
I said, I feel like that is the word. Maybe that'll be my word of the year, is just EBITDA.
That'd be awesome.
I love it. No, that's really cool. And I also love the automation thing. I mean, that's really smart. And I do think there is something to be said about what your concept is, which is bringing in really smart people and giving them tasks. It's like almost like coming in with fresh eyes. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes I think people who have all this experience in one way, shape, or form of a certain niche within even a company, or like if you're a brand marketer or whatever, you've been not brainwashed, but you've worked for maybe other brands and you know exactly how those brands did it, but you guys are doing everything different. And the automation, paying for executive assistants to help just get time off their plate, that's really interesting. And it kind of reminds me of what you said about your guys' kind of scrappy way of working with Reddit, right? Totally. That seems like kind of a scaled version of that. Like, you guys have kind of kept that mentality of how do you unlock more time? Exactly. Really cool. It's cool how you guys have applied tech to what you're doing now with Ramen. That's super cool, man. I like that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's hard too, because I think a lot of times you don't want to run the risk of being too techie, right? Like, you don't want to become the Soylent of the world. Ultimately, like, people have to believe you have a delicious product, and oh, by the way, it happens to be healthy. So none of this stuff is stuff we ever really message to our end consumers. It's like really reserved for these podcasts.
Yeah, for but, sure. No, that's cool. It's behind the scenes a little bit.
For sure.
Very cool. And what was funny, I was reading, I think it was TechCrunch that you guys had an article in when you did your raise back in 21. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you too, it kind of all ties in with what we just talked about, but you had mentioned in there that you're a productivity junkie, and something on here that I always ask at the very end, and I'll ask you the question when we get there, is relative to like how you essentially like how you think about your days, your weeks, your year. How do you like boil the ocean of what you want to accomplish, and what tools do you use to really get down to that? So you being a productivity guy, now I'm hearing your guys' story of how you apply that to the rest of your company. Knowing that you oversee so many different parts of Emmy now, like Emmy's growing, you're growing a team. I would love to understand when you say you're into productivity, is a lot of that automation, or is a lot of that, do you have some hacky ways, tools that you use to achieve goals, to get shit done on a daily basis? Would love to just know what your process is, because I also like to think I'm a productivity junkie, mm-hmm. but I also know I'm an overanalyzer sometimes. So sometimes I'll like get way too obsessed with one way of doing it, and then I'm like, oh, I just need to like redo all of it because this process isn't working well enough for me. And I'm like, just stick with your process. So that's me in a nutshell. But would love to hear what you do, because it sounds like from a business perspective, you guys have figured out some pretty cool ways to help your team unlock more time and just be more productive in general.
For sure. I love that question. I think I rarely get the productivity questions, which is awesome. I love talking about it. I think the first thing, and you know this too, Shane, is like, yeah, doing productivity for the sake of productivity, it's like, you obviously want to do something with that time that you get. So it's like, that's the most important thing. But yeah, even for us, for example, in our onboarding guide, like when new team members join, we have like a productivity resources section where we're like actually sharing with them like Loom videos of how we run our own task management dashboards. We have all the tools that we use on our Mac app, like all the Mac apps that we use on a daily basis to help drive productivity. Things like Command E, which I think has now become Dropbox Dash. It allows you to quickly search for any file quickly. We have all sorts of these tips because we just know that, you know, ultimately like a manager's role is like you're driving output for that of like the people in your organization and the organization that surrounds your organization. And so you do want to, this goes back to the leveraging of each team member. My first month usually of onboarding any team member when I'm doing one-on-ones with them is not necessarily digging into like the role responsibilities or anything like that. It's actually helping them figure out what is the task and project management dashboard that's going to get you to get into your flow and like finish all the stuff that you are responsible for. Because if you can't take care of yourself, you can't put the oxygen mask on yourself first, you're not going to help anyone else. So we quite literally, I'm like pushing on them. I'm like, hey guys, here's my Notion dashboard. Here's all, it's like a my personal Notion dashboard is a combination of the Eisenhower matrix combined with another thing called the one thing. And so I have everything prioritized by those matrices, but then I'm only ever working on one thing at any given time. And then what I then do is like at the end of every week, I'm actually going back and I'm looking like, hey, of the Eisenhower matrix, what tasks did I get done in the important and urgent or these other categories? How can I recalibrate for future weeks? That sounds very complex to most people, but that's something I developed over the course of like many, many years. And I kind of evolved to get there because that's how I get into my flow. Other people, it may not be the case, but it doesn't matter. Like for them, I just want them to know you should have a task and project management dashboard set up, because in a startup, we are going to give you a ton of responsibility. And if you cannot handle like not just your own one list of checklist of list of items, but you're going to have multiple projects and each project has its own task list. How are you going to be able to prioritize what tasks to work on any project at any given time? There should be no downtime, right? Like when we were product managers in tech, our whole, it was basically like a made up role that tech had where like at a certain point, engineers and designers, it didn't make sense for them to have to plan what they should be working on. So rather than that, they hired a product manager who would like work with users and better understand the roadmap so that engineers and designers literally would have no downtime. They could just like always have a spec ready to work on their next feature. We try to do that with every team member where we're like, you shouldn't have any idle time during the day. Like you can, of course you can do whatever the hell you want. Like we trust you, but you shouldn't be sitting around being like twiddling your thumbs, be like, what should I do next? You should have a prioritized list so that we don't have to be in control of your schedule. You can be in control of your schedule. And that's what we emphasize a lot. And then of course I could pair that with a bunch of other stuff around like Loom, no code tools, but fundamentally each person needs to have a good task management system that works for them. And then they'll kind of evolve from there.
That's really, really cool. And Notion is what you kind of lean on the most?
We use Notion for everything. We also have like a company system within Notion that we borrowed from another system called Bulletproof. It's a way to like easily manage projects and then like multiple team members can work on any project together. But you can find this online. It's available for anyone.
That's really cool. I mean, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think there's, I mean, again, owning my own business now, before that working at RX, like there's just so everyone thinks their thing is the priority. So I love that, because I think what ends up happening as you scale is everything is can't be a priority. And the Eisenhower matrix, that's something I've messed around with. Love that. I've been thinking about bringing that back into the forefront of what I do, because I genuinely think that's such a cool tool that just helps really put into context how important and urgent things are versus just putting out fires all day. Because I'm sure it sounds like you have this under control. It is easy, I would think, for most people who are in startup environments where there's just lots coming in the inbox. If you always have your inbox up, you just feel like you're reactive versus really putting your head down and working on these big, thoughtful projects. One thing, and you don't know this, but I was reading the TechCrunch thing, and I might have jumped onto something else. I can't remember when I was doing some research on Emmy, but I want to steal this from you. You talked about in one of your articles having like one day a week where you just no meetings, like no calls, no meetings, and it's for you to just do deep work. And I think that is a really interesting concept, because it just in this day and age, especially with all being remote now post COVID, and unless you went back to an office, it's so easy to look at your calendar and it just people have taken the whole every day of the week, and it's like, when do you actually get the hard work done where you need to be like headphones in, focused?
Yeah.
So I love that. I just wanted to let you know that. I thought that was really interesting and something I need to adopt, because in my line of work, which I could talk to you about too offline, but it's like you need time just to get the work done. And if you're always in meetings or always just responding to email, it's tough to do. So
agree.
Appreciate all the stuff you've put out there, because I think a lot of people can learn from it. And I'll check out the tools that you just mentioned. I think that's really beneficial for people.
For sure. I appreciate that. Yeah, I think it's like one of those things where a long time ago, I kind of came to this conclusion. Like a lot of life, you can find meaning in many ways, but for like there's a reason why like that Maslow's hierarchy of needs is like a thing, because it's like, yes, we all grew up, you know, some of us had deficiency needs where we cared a lot about like the food, shelter, safety. And then as you progress, you start to develop like more of that growth mindset. And that's basically like what I've come to term in, like, that's what a company really is like. You bring on these team members and you're helping them kind of progress through that Maslow's hierarchy, where you want to get them to a growth mindset as quickly as possible so that they operate independently. They're almost like mini entrepreneurs within your organization and they don't need you to guide them. And so me telling them like, hey, I really want you to focus on your project and task management is not me being like a productivity junkie per se. It's just like, I've seen how powerful it is in my own life, where if I can control completing all of my tasks in my work, both in my professional and personal life, you just develop so quickly as an individual. And mm-hmm. you start to develop trust with your managers, they'll give you more responsibility. So we want, you know, our organization to be a place of that kind of learning and development and for everyone.
Very cool. No, I love that, Kevin. That's really, really cool. And it sounds like a place where I have a feeling you're going to have a lot of people. I'm sure the more of this kind of stuff you do, the more people are going to want to reach out and possibly work with you and for you. It sounds exciting. It sounds like a fun place to be.
Thank you.
So my questions I always like to wrap up as if we're getting to the end of the hour. The first one was the productivity tool. So love that. And thanks for giving a deep dive into that. The other one, which I'm pumped, I feel like you're going to have a good answer to this, is source of knowledge. So for everyone listening, for you, Kevin, something recently, either that a book you read, a podcast you listened to, an article you've read, just anything, source of knowledge that was impactful to you that you want to share with the audience today.
Yeah, I think that there was a really good podcast I listened to recently. It was the Patrick O'Shaughnessy's Invest Like the Best podcast. And he interviewed a guy named John Fio, who is the creator of like Moon Pods, the Gravity Blanket, like four different businesses that maybe you've heard of as a consumer. And it's just fascinating to hear him. Like, this guy, John Fio, used to be like a jazz artist. And then he went to go work for Scooter Braun and like worked with Justin Bieber. And like,
whoa.
And then he branched off and started Gravity Blankets and it just like blew up. And the podcast is about something about like believing in magic, which is obviously a great positioning title. But what's valuable to the podcast is he really explains the magic of positioning. And I think positioning is not something, it's like a classic marketing concept that I frankly did not really understand coming into the consumer brand world, but positioning is everything, right? It's like, he could have called it like the 50-pound blanket or whatever, but he called it a gravity blanket. And there's a reason why, despite many competitors, the gravity blanket is the one that took off because of the way he positioned it in the market. Him and I, like recently we were trying to figure out how to position Emmy. Not that like we have different positioning statements, but he's like, what's the one that's going to take off for you? And it's just like, I think a lot of people don't think about this when they first start a brand, naturally, because there's probably a ton of things to think about. But John Fio, he's like a big believer that you should spend the majority of your time in positioning, and that actually will help you define like what product you should build. And it's kind of like, it's like another way of thinking about how we did the demand testing, where we were like, okay, we think low carb, high protein, plant-based is going to be the most important. We didn't realize back then that was like a positioning thing. We were just like, that's value props and that'll help us figure out what to build. But I think for anyone listening, go check out that podcast. I think it's like that podcast has been around for a while and John just went on the podcast and now it's like a top five podcast of all downloads.
Oh, wow.
So,
okay. I didn't know that. I'll definitely listen.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's probably like my podcast recommendation book. I'm like 25% of the way through a book called Good Strategy, Bad Strategy. It's about this like professor who just helps define, I think strategy is a loose term that gets thrown around a lot. And he really tries to define like what is good strategy and what is bad strategy in the context of like using real world case studies from companies, because strategy sounds so obvious in hindsight. It's like, you look at it, you're like, oh yeah, of course Apple would launch like the iPad, duh. But that's because it was like a very clear calculated set of decisions that were planned for years that got to that point. And like when you get to a point where you have product market fit, good strategy is what sets you apart from every other business that has product market fit as well. So I'm thinking a lot about that as we start to scale Emmy and, you know, think about what'll happen when the big companies come after us or like competitors come up.
Sure. Oh yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Okay. Well, great. Well, you gave everyone a bonus. You gave people two there. I'm pumped to check both those out. Actually, that strategy one sounds really interesting. I'm going to add that to my book list. So thank you. And Kevin, with 1 minute left, wanted to make sure we all always fit in for people listening who I'm sure now after listening to this was a fun podcast, are interested in learning more about Emmy. Besides the normal things, like I'll add the links to your guys' website and social media and to your LinkedIn and all that fun stuff. For people listening who want to try it, where do you recommend they go learn more about Emmy? Where can they go buy it? And where can they learn more about you?
You can buy us, you know, online our website, emmyeats.com. We can also find us in retailers, Whole Foods, Fresh Market. We'll be launching in Wegmans soon, and then crossing our fingers on two other huge accounts that hopefully will close. But yeah, you can find me on Twitter as well, Kevin Lee Me. And yeah, thanks so much for listening.
Awesome. Well, Kevin, thank you so much, man. It was a pleasure meeting you. Loved the podcast. That was fun to learn more about your brand and honestly how you work. I think you have a really, really creative way that you guys are building this that I didn't know about before today. So I appreciate the time, man.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Kevin. We'll talk soon.
All right.